And today we're going to try historically, geographically, archaeologically to understand the events that led to the Hashmonai Revolt and some of the battles of the Hashmonai Revolt itself. Of course, we're going to start a lot before that. First of all, a couple of introductions. Most of our sources for the precise history and the different battles and where they took place come from what's known as the Book of the Maccabees. The Book of the Maccabees is not part of the Kislev Kodesh. It's not part of Tanakh, and therefore should be treated as such, which means it's not written in the Ruach HaKodesh. It didn't pass through the inspection of the Chachamim. First, page number 2 contains a link to the Book of Maccabees in English. So if you want to see the text, I'm not going to quote verbatim from the book, but it's based on the Book of Maccabees, and a lot of Rishonim, one of the hot sources on the story of Hanukkah, based it on a sefer called Yosifun, which was adapted from Josephus, and Josephus is clear that he had access to the Book of the Maccabees. Now, there are two books of the Maccabees. There's Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2. Maccabees 1 is considered to be a more Jewish source, while Maccabees 2 was probably written in Egypt and contains a lot less. Mostly we'll be relying on the Book of Maccabees 1. So that's important to mention in our source. In general, what we're going to try to do is take the few sources in the Chazal. Remember that Chazal are not a history book. They're coming to teach us halachos. But there, here and there, we can see the differences that fit into the general historical picture and the archaeological picture, and based on that, we're going to start going. We'll start, if you have your Hebrew page, which is source number 1 on the main page, the PDF file, we're going to come up with a Gemara of the Zara, source 1.1 on the Hebrew PDF file, where the Gemara divides up the history of the second Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, according to Chazal, stood for 420 years. I'm not going to go into the question. It's a complicated issue. Scientifically, in any science book, you'll see that the second Beis HaMikdash stood close to 600 years. According to Josephus, it even exceeded 600 years, close to 630 years. Chazal say it's still for 420 years. Again, I'm not going into the question because it's a very complicated issue, and that is not the point of discussion tonight. The Gemara says like this: Vatanya Rav Yossi the Rebbe, Malchus Paras with Me'abayi Shloshim V'Arav Hashanah. The Persian kingdom, and that was Bnei Yisrael when they rebuilt the second Beis HaMikdash. They rebuilt it under the king Koresh, Cyrus, and they remained under his rule for 34 years. Malchus Yavam was Me'abayis Me'oshmonim Shem. The Hellenistic period, when the Jews were under Greek control, total 180 years. Malchus Chashmonai was Me'abayis Me'oshmonim Shem. The Chashmonai dynasty ruled for 103 years, and Malchus Beis Hargus ruled Me'oshmonim Shem. Total 420 years. So the Gemara divides it up into four different periods. The Persian period is 34 years. The Hellenistic period is 180, and the Hashmonai period 103, and the Herodian period 103. Okay, we're not going to go into the whole discussion exactly how this fits, but the bottom line is we see over here that the Hashmonai period lasts for 103 years, and the Herodian period 103 years, which means the Beis HaMikdash remains standing after the story of Hanukkah for another 200 years. Later on, we will quote the Rambam, who this is the source for Hanukkah. Okay, let's start with the history. After the Persian period, Alexander the Great comes and captures Eretz Yisrael and around the year 322 BC. He comes, he captures not only Eretz Yisrael, he captures Egypt, he captures all of Asia, he goes running everywhere, and Eretz Yisrael is under Greek control. Alexander dies, there's no one person who can actually contain this entire empire. And the empire is divided up into four different parts. But the two parts that basically interest us are the Egyptian Ptolemy dynasty, which ruled in Egypt, and its capital was Alexandria, and the Seleucid dynasty, which ruled in Syria, Iraq, and its capital was Antioch. And as you can imagine, I don't know if you have a map, but Eretz Yisrael is wham smack in between these two capitals, which means that anytime there'll be war, Eretz Yisrael will be in trouble. And that's indeed what happened for over 100 years. Ptolemy and Antiochus, the Seleucid dynasty versus the Ptolemy dynasty, were going at war against each other, trying to gain territory from each other, and Eretz Yisrael suffered alone. For the first 100 years, Eretz Yisrael was under the Ptolemy dynasty, and from Egypt. And from that we have a Gemara, I didn't quote it here, but it's a Gemara in Megillah, Maseches Daf Tesvav, that tells us that Ptolemy wanted to know what it said in the Torah. The Torah was written in Lashon HaKodesh, of course. He did not know Lashon HaKodesh, and he requested that Chachamim send him a bunch of Chachamim. He didn't tell him what the purpose was, so they all came, put them all into separate rooms, 70 Chachamim, and he put them all into different rooms, and so someone wanted to translate the Torah. You know, he wanted to check to see that he actually got the real thing, and then he all translated exactly the same thing. Because they'll tell us that there were 13 times that they changed, they altered slightly certain things, because they knew that if they translated the way it was, people will run into Talmud will have questions that will be difficult to answer, and therefore they changed it, and that was an ace. Hashem made it that they all figured out the exact 13 places where to change. Okay, that's an interesting point. I have Teves is coming up. The Age of Teves, one of the tragedies that happened, Chazal tell us that the world, after this, was in darkness for 3 days. You know, Hashem was not happy that this happened, because until now the Torah was only in the possession of Eretz Yisrael, and now it becomes accessible to all. And but the bottom line is, the story that we see from here, the Eretz Yisrael are under the Talmud, at a certain period, under the Talmud control. Around the year 200 BCE, the Seleucid dynasty from Syria wins a crucial battle in a place called Panyon, which we identify today as the Banias, the famous place up north near the Hermon, and the Seleucids take control of Eretz Yisrael pretty much for good. The wars will somewhat continue, and the war with Talmud in Egypt is not over yet, because Antiochus will try to capture Egypt also, and for that, of course, he'll have to go through Eretz Yisrael. So maybe Eretz Yisrael itself remained under Seleucid control, but peace was far from it. Before we go on, just another small introduction that we want to mention is talking about historically who lived in Eretz Yisrael at the time. Now, it's important to know that the Jews, when they came back from Babel, they were small amounts, they were not such a large group. They lived in three basic places. They lived in Yehuda, in Judea, which was more centered around Yerushalayim. They lived in the Galil, and some of them lived on the other side of the Jordan, known as Transjordan, but they lived in three separate areas. The rest of the country was inhabited by non-Jews, was inhabited by pagans, at the beginning, mostly by those nations which were familiar from Tanakh, such as the Philistines at the coast, the northern coast, the Phoenicians, and in the east of Eretz Yisrael, you still have those nations like Edom had moved into south of Eretz Yisrael, while in the east you have Ammon and Moab. Those nations that we know from Tanakh still existed at the beginning of the Second Mizrach. Now, the Greeks, Chazal referred to Talmai as Greek, as we mentioned, and Chazal referred to the Seleucid dynasty as Greeks. Likewise, they're both Greeks. In essence, 100 years later, very few of them were actual people who lived in Greece. But evidently, we're not talking about Greek people, Greek nationality, Greek origin. We're talking about Greek culture. Now, as we have to understand what the Greek culture did to to the world in order to understand what happened over here. The Greeks, needless to mention the whole history, but the Greeks, the wise, the philosophers, the mathematicians, what that? That the Greeks actually developed a new system in life, and their life is to start living for pleasure. And it's basically the roots of modern democracy today, no doubt, began in Greece then. It was later expanded by the Romans. And today, the fact that democracy, the base of its foundations, are from Greece. Now, the Greeks had a system, and they had a system in which their culture was able to overwhelm every other nation around. As we mentioned moments ago, that all those nations mentioned in Tanakh, such as the Philistines, the Phoenicians, Edom, Ammon, Moab, all those existed at the beginning of the second Bais HaMikdash, and suddenly disappeared. They didn't just suddenly disappear. They were absorbed by the Greek culture. The Greek culture was overwhelming. The Greek culture was comfortable. The Greek culture was nice. A couple of words about the Greek culture. They changed the whole concept of a city. Until then, a city belonged to the king. The king had his palace. There might have been a temple in the city, and that was it. The purpose of the city was to serve the king. But later on, when the Greeks came along, they invented what's called the polis, and the polis had a policy where the city can get a form of semi-independence if they met certain conditions. And the conditions were that the city had to be built in a certain style, had to be built with right angle, with 90 degree intersections, and had to be built with public buildings which assisted the public. And if you look at the source papers we have over here, take a look at source number 4, you have the Athens Acropolis. This picture was taken by yours truly a couple months ago, which is typical. It's a little hard to see, but the mountain on top overlooking Athens and the ruins of the Parthenon, which can clearly be seen on top. This is a typical Acropolis sitting in a Greek city with a temple on top, and the rest of the all the like the marketplace, the Agora, and all the other public buildings are sitting below in the valley underneath. And one more source to look at for now is source number 11, which is a picture of a Greek theater. And once again, this is also in the Acropolis in Athens. And this theater is meant for musicals, for plays, like we know it today. The origin began in Greece. And again, this was part of the culture. This is part of the way that the Greeks spread their culture and actually overwhelmed all the nations that they captured, except for one nation, and that nation was the Jewish people. But we'll get to that in a moment. I don't have a map here to show you. In general, the polis system, where the Greeks granted a small amount of autonomy to these cities, provided they had an aqueduct which supplied water, public buildings. They gave them the villages around it, which actually supported them agriculturally. If you look at a map, you'll see, I don't have a map to show you, I'm sorry, but the whole coast of Eretz Yisrael was taken up by such cities, including Akko, which got a Greek name, which was named Patomais, named after Talmai, and Yafo, and Gaza, all along the coast. All these cities became independent polises, which means these cities were non-Jewish. The population along the coast was totally not a Jewish population. Most of the cities got Greek names eventually too. The interesting thing is that these Greek names may have lasted for 1,000 years, but when Muslims came and conquered Eretz Yisrael in the year 638, the original biblical names, Tanakh names, returned. So if Akko became Ptolemais, later on it became Akko. And if Beit Sha'an, which we'll refer to later, became Schizopolis, later on it was restored to Beit Sha'an when the Muslims came. So somehow the original Tanakh name survived. The Greek culture, Chazal opposed the Greek culture, the Greek mythology, they cursed whoever will learn, Chachma Yavanis. But on the other hand, Chazal admired the Greek culture. If you look at the Hebrew source page, the PDF source, it's 2.1, we have over here an interesting thing. The Gemara discusses in Megillah if you can write Sefer Torah, Shulchan and Mezuzos in different languages. And the Gemara quotes over here, Rosh Bagel, man, after Sfarim lay two, Sheikosu Eli Yivonis. Even Sfarim, they didn't permit in all languages, as opposed to Tanakama, who holds you can write in any language. There's only one language. You can only write in Greek. Amar Bebo, according to Gemara, Amar Biachon Halacha Kerashbahad, the Halacha is like a Shekman Gamliel, that you can write them only in Greek. The Yama Biachon and Maitama Kerashbahad, what's the reason of Rav Shimon Gamliel? What's the reason that Rav Shimon Gamliel holds you can only write it in Greek and not any other language? Why specifically Greek? Amar Kla, the prophet says, Yasta Lokim Legepes, the Yishkan Baal Hashem. Dvarav Shal Yepes, Yiru Baal Hashem. The words of Yepes, meaning the language of Yepes. And the Gemara goes on to explain that the Yepes, the beauty of Yepes, which is Greek, his word shall be Baal Hashem. So now what Chazal tells us that the beauty of Yepes, which is Greek, his word shall be Baal Hashem. So you see, the Chazal, for someone, had admiration for the Greek to some extent, and they considered the language of the Greek language a beautiful language, which is suitable for writing Sefer Torah. So the Greeks capture the Seleucids capture Antiochus the Third captures Eretz Yisrael, and on the way back from his victory, he stops by in Yerushalayim, and not what we know about Antiochus the Fourth, the one from Hanukkah. Antiochus the Third makes a decree, and in his decree, he writes a document that A, the Kabbalos in the Beit HaMikdash will come from his own private treasury. He will pay for it. Something similar to what we saw that the Persian king in Ezra Nehemiah, that the Persian king paid for. And the Yehoshua says he'll support it. And the Jews shall keep their own laws. And the laws of Yerushalayim shall forbid the sale of Chazer, of pygmy, in Yerushalayim, because it's a Jewish city. And therefore they will not, no selling of any non-Jewish animal. So Antiochus comes along, Antiochus the Third, and he grants the Jews special rights as Jews because they supported him in his battle on the way when he went to war against Talmud and was restored. The story changed somewhat as times went on. Eventually, we get to Antiochus the Fourth, who is the Antiochus of Chanukah. And we're talking over here around the year 168 BCE, and Antiochus is the first one who starts interfering with the way things will run in the Beis HaMikdash. Until then, as we saw, Antiochus III let things go the way they were. The Kohen Gadol was the most righteous person who could be, and he remained Kohen Gadol until he died, and when he died, if the son was capable, he took over. Antiochus IV, he already got more involved in what's going on in the Beit HaMikdash. In his days already, there was the beginning of Hellenization even among the Jews. And for that example, if you look at source number 2.3, we have a story of, in the Hebrew sources, the story quoted in the end is more in Sukkot, Ma'isa b'Miriam b'Bilga she'nir adasa. It's the story of Miriam, the daughter of Bilga. Bilga is one of the 24 Mishmaras that served in the Beit HaMikdash, and we'll discuss that soon. And she converted to Hellenism and married some high officer. So we see the concept of Hellenization had already begun. Antiochus starts appointing his own Kohen Gadol, and his own Kohen Gadol is a person who A, will support his cause financially, and B, culturally. Financially, which means whoever can offer him the highest price will become Kohen Gadol. Now, how does the person offer him a high price? Only one way, and that's by putting taxes on the people. So the Kohen Gadol, you know, comes to the king, he says, I'll pay you $1 million, but that $1 million is obviously going to come out of the pocket of all the Jews. The Kohen Gadol, you have to realize, is the highest Jewish official. At the time, there's no king, and the people are suffering. So the two famous names, one was Jason, and later on, Antiochus appointed another Kohen Gadol named Menelaus, both who were Hellenistic, who were people who already had begun to absorb Hellenistic culture. It was then that as Yerachus even wanted to make Yerushalayim into a polis, meaning into a Greek city, and start Greek customs, like having a gymnasium, people, Greek style athletics, etc., and having that all in Yerushalayim. According to Maccabees II, the people, the Kohanim, serving in Yerushalayim would rush to finish their avodah in the Beis HaMikdash in order to go and see the athletic competition. Well, the interesting thing is that the Bach in Hilchos Chanukah said that the chait that Klal Yisrael did was mishlashlum avodah. The chait they did was that when they came to avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, they took it lightly, they didn't take it seriously, and therefore they were punished that they had to come with Mesiras Nefesh. And this matches what he says. So, in essence, the Hellenization process began, source number 2-4, I'm not going to read it because time is really short, but also mentions a similar thing, that in the first place, I mean, just it stood for 410 years. There were a total of 12 Kohanim Gedolim who served, here it says 18, but of course here it says 12, there were 12 Kohanim Gedolim who served throughout that period of 410 years. In the second place, I mean, just, besides a few Kohanim Gedolim actually served for a long time, there were over 300 Kohanim Gedolim, which means an average of 1 year, which means they didn't live out the year, and that was a punishment because these people were not worthy of being Kohanim Gedolim. The only way they ever got into this position was that they guarded the king. And this began in the days of Antiochus IV. Antiochus started this Hellenization process, and then he went back to Mitzrayim, he went back to war against Egypt a second time. The first time he came back, one of the first things he did was he was going to go to war in Asia. And war costs money. And the typical way that these kings financed the wars was they knew that temples that nations had always had a lot of money because people donated. And they always would go and loot the money, the gold that was in these temples, and this is how they supported the war. And this case was no different than the Yerachus looted the treasures of the Beis HaMikdash. He appointed Menelaus, as we mentioned, a Hellenistic a Hellenized Jew, to be Kohen Gadol. He went to war again against Mitzrayim a while later, and rumors spread that that he was killed. And when the rumors spread that he was killed, the previous Kohen Gadol, Ligason, had been ousted by him, started a revolt against Menelaus. At the time, in order to make sure that Yerushalayim became a Hellenized city, Antiochus had brought a bunch of non-Jews to live in a fortress called the Chakor. There was a fortress, and the non-Jews lived there, and the only way Menelaus was saved was that he escaped to this fortress where his friends were, the non-Jews. When Antiochus came back from the shrine, he was not really dead, he was furious at what happened, and he slaughtered thousands of Jews in Yerushalayim. And it was then that he made the decrees against the Jewish people. Why? Historians still debate it, because this was an unprecedented thing in all of history, that a nation should be forced, try to get another nation to convert. But the bottom line was that he probably had been convinced that most of the Jews would not mind adopting the Hellenistic culture, and it's just a handful of stubborn Jews who don't, and by forcing them, the problem will be solved. So that's when Antiochus made his famous decrees, you know, the decree against Shabbat, the decree against the Mila, the decree against the Chodesh, the law that the Jews have to sacrifice non-kosher animals on altars in different cities. And all that we know, that's what came from the decrees of Antiochus. Anyone who violated these things were punished by death. And the Jewish reaction to these decrees of Antiochus were actually in four main directions. There were some people who said, you know, okay, we have no choice, we'll go along with it. There was a second group who were actually suicidal, meaning we're going to do it even though we get killed. Actually, suicidal is not a good term, but in other words, they decided whatever happens, they will do, and that's it. They don't care if they get killed. The third group ran away into the mountains into the desert to hide and keep the mitzvahs over there. And there was a fourth group, the Chashmonaim, who led the revolt against the Seleucid army, we should call it, because that's actually who they fought. We'll take a half a minute break over here. If any particular questions. Okay, let's proceed. So this is the stage where the war begins. I have to go through the whole story. We know the story that the Greek officer came to. We're going to a town called Modi'in, and Modi'in is the hometown of the Hashmonaim. Where is Modi'in? There are a couple suggestions for it. I'm not going to go into full detail because time is really short. But if you look at source number 9 on your source page, I have a Hebrew map, and over here we have a couple suggestions where Modi'in is. In Chazal, this, of course, the source of the Maccabees came from a town called Modi'in, is mentioned in the Book of the Maccabees. In Chazal, we do have one, from what I know, we do have one place where Chazal do mention the fact that the town of Modi'in is where Hashmonaim come from. If you look at source 5.1 in the Hebrew source page, you'll see it mentions it also with Yanei HaMelech, and they question his ability to be a Kohen Gadol, because they said that his mother had been taken captive. And the last line, which is underlined, mentions that his mother was taken captive in a town called Modi'in. So in other words, this is one place where Chazal do connect the Chashmonaim. Yana, of course, was a much later king, but they connect the Chashmonaim to the town of Modi'in. Where is Modi'in exactly? So if you take a look over here at the source places I mentioned, and if you look at the Hebrew, and if you look at the Hebrew source page, take a look at source 5.2, it's a Mishnah that says, Ezi derech hachoka, what's a distant way from Yerushalayim on Erech Pesach? Min ha-Modi'in v'lachut. If you're outside of Modi'in, and the last line is, Omar Ula, min ha-Modi'in v'Yerushalayim, chamisha asamim. From Modi'in to Yerushalayim, you're talking about 15 miles. So the Gemara gives a distance of Yerushalayim to Modi'in 15 miles, and throughout the ages, there were different suggestions where Modi'in actually is. If you look at number one, first of all, you see Yerushalayim on the right side of the map, and take a look at the line which begins with an aleph and ends with an aleph. That's the perimeter of 15 mil. So the Gemara defines that 15 miles, that's approximately where it should be. Source number one puts in a place called Sova, which is not far from where we are now, in Telstone, and that's by Captain Leferach. That's number one. Number two, Yamatun. Okay, that's not so relevant for us. We're going to mention the few that was released today is where you have the base and Gimel on the left side. There's an Arab village, and the Arab village over here is called Almedia. Again, there's no positive identification, but the Arab village over here is called Almedia, which resembles the name of Modi'in, and one of the big sources in identifying ancient places is based on the current Arabic name. So this seems to match A, the name, but B is also the location, because if the Mishnah mentions that who is on a distance, who's considered distant from Yerushalayim and Erech Pesach when it comes to bring Korban Pesach, evidently we're talking about a place that's along the main highway. The main highway going to Yerushalayim, and it tells you if you pass kilometer so and so, you're close to Yerushalayim. If you didn't pass it, you're outside of Yerushalayim. So evidently along the main highway, if you go along verse 5-3 on the Hebrew source page, again it talks about people in Modi'in going on the way to Yerushalayim. So that's why the area today, the modern area today, which is called Modi'in, which is along, okay, might not mean much to you, I mentioned highway number 443, but the old road to Yerushalayim from Yafo is not the main highway that's used today. It's a little farther north, and it runs through an area called Modi'in, and from there comes into Yerushalayim from the north. That is an ancient route, And we'll soon see that that also played a major role in the Maccabee battles. And that fits the description. True, it's a little more than 15 mil in 30 mil, but on the other hand, the name, and we know from archaeological excavations that the area was Jewish during the Second Beit HaMikdash, so that's also important. And the name and the fact that it's along a major road, those things put together and put in a vote that that is indeed the actual Modi'in. Nearby, by the way, I have a friend, his name is Zohar Bar'am, and he took a little hill. Instead of going into agriculture like everyone else and building some greenhouses, he decided to do something more educational with his hill. And what he did was, he built a reconstructed Hashmonai village. He took this hill and made it to look like a town just as it was 2,000 years ago in the days of the Hashmonai. So that's interesting, an interesting place to visit when you come by. Okay, so that's one. Source there from the Book of the Maccabees mentions another thing, was that they were from the family of Yehoyarib. What does this mean, the family of Yehoyarib? In the Beit HaMikdash, there were 24 mishmaros, 24 families that worked, alternated on a weekly basis. Not everyone came every day. Every week, a different family came. This was set up already from the beginning, from David HaMelech, from the first Beit HaMikdash, and every week, a different group came. Yehoyarib is the first, Yehoyarib is the first family of Kohanim. Take a look on the Hebrew source, page 4.1. It has a quote from Divrei Yamim Chav Daled, and it mentions by Yetzer Dor LaRishon Li Yehoyarib Li Bnei Hasheni. So Yehoyarib was the first, and you can assume that the Kohen Gadol would come from the first family actually. And we mentioned the name of Yehoyarib Ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol, so it fits with the fact that he was from Yehoyarib. Time is short, so I'm not going to go into the whole source mentioned here that the Gemara mentions during the second Beit HaMikdash. Only four of the original families of Kohanim returned to Eretz Yisrael from Bavel. The rest remained in Bavel. So what did they do with these four families of Kohanim? They split them up. Each of these families split up into six. But it seems that they acquired, when they split them up, each of the six, they acquired names of the original families. And if we'll go back, and on the Hebrew source page to 2.3, where we told the story of Miriam, it mentions Miriam Bat Bilga. Bilga was the name of one of those families of Kohanim, family number 15. So we see that they still kept those names. Bilga, by the way, if you look at the on the source page number 6, over here we have a seal which was found from the first Beit HaMikdash. It was destroyed in the days of the Churban, and the seal of an ancient Hebrew script mentions the name Bilga. 51 clay seals were found in this building, and three of them carry the name Bilga. So we see the, again, that doesn't necessarily mean that's from that family, but we see that that name carries on. Another family of Kohanim, which we know, is the family of Chizir. Take a look at source number 13. And over there you see in Nachal Kidron, the famous monolithic monument, Yadav Shalom Kibbutz Chaya, and a beautiful cover over there with two pillars in the center. On top of the pillars is an inscription. You cannot see it from the picture. And the inscription mentions that this is a tomb, and it lists the names of the people from Bnei Chizir. Chizir is family number 17 of the Mishmaros. So we see, this is second verse, and at this time, we see that they kept the names of the Mishmaros, and we know, in Tishabah, we say a special kino, it mentioned that the 24 Mishmaros left Yerushalayim and settled in the Galil. So we see that they actually kept the names of the Mishmaros. Okay, on to the Hashmonai results. We're talking over here in the year 167 BCE, the Hashmonai revolt. Now, in order to understand the revolt, in order to understand the battles, It's important. The main word, the key word over here is called topography. To understand the topography, to understand what went on. And for this, take a look at source number 3, Judean Hills map. And this, although it says on the top 3D Judean Desert map, but that's a wrong, title. It's the Judean Hills. And this is the key. The Jews lived around Yerushalayim in the hilly region of the country. The coast, as I told you, was occupied by non-Jews, and non-Jewish population, not good friends of the Jews. In order for the Seleucid army to get to Yerushalayim, they somehow have to climb up onto these hilly regions. Of course, they're at a disadvantage at first in order to get to Yerushalayim. In the north, the hilly regions bordered by Shomron, which is the Shomronim or the Kusim, I don't know if you can call them Jewish or not. In the south, Hebron area is covered by the Edomites. The first thing the Hashmonaim do is they run away from their town of Modiin, which is in the plain. And in the plain, of course, they're at a disadvantage. After they realize the Greek army is a well-trained army, the system was called the flanks, they have developed. And that's a good army for fighting in an open area. It's not such a good army for fighting in the hilly region. Fighting in the hilly region is always much more complicated. So they run away from their place, and they hide in the mountains of Shomron. It's believed that they hide in the Gophna Hills, which is north of Ramallah. They hide in the Gophna Hills, and there they start by force. They start forcing the people who didn't give the kids a bris. They gave the kids a bris. They forced the people around to keep the mitzvahs. And before you know it, they're starting a revolt against the Greek army. Now at first, the Greek army, the Seleucid army, is not, you know, too concerned with a handful of people over here. At first they send probably a small group and a local garrison, which is probably stationed in Shomron, led by a person called Apollonius. Apollonius comes, and he's coming from the north, from the Shechem area, and Yehuda Maccabee, the five brothers, is Yehuda, Yochanan, Yonatan, Shimon, and Elazar, the five brothers. Yehuda is a leader, he's the strongest, and Yehuda wipes out Apollonius. It's assumed there's two places along the way, where it's a steep climb, or the road goes into a narrow gorge, one of those two places where they ambushed the Greek army, and Yehuda kills Apollonius, and from then on, he used the sword that he took from Apollonius. So he wipes out the local army. The Greeks, okay, may be getting a little concerned, not too much. And again, we'll send a small army. But the small army now, they're going to have to bring it from somewhere else. If they don't have a local army, they're going to have to bring it from somewhere along the coast. And in order to bring it from somewhere along the coast, they're going to have to climb those hills into, climb into the Judean Hills. And again, that's a major disadvantage. And the first attempt, which is battle number 2, against the general called Seron, he will go up that same road that we mentioned minutes ago, the road coming up from Modiin towards Yerushalayim. A couple words about this road. This road is known as Ma'alei Beit Choron, the ascent of Beit Choron. It's mentioned in Chazal and the Gemara Rosh Hashanah as a narrow ascent, where only one person can only go single file. So already the Greeks, which are accustomed to go 16 people wide in their army, they're already at a disadvantage when they have to climb single file. There's two towns along this road. There's Beit Choron Elyon, the upper Beit Choron, and there's Beit Choron Tachton, the lower Beit Choron, places mentioned in Tanakh, and a steep climb in between. This road has been known to be one of the toughest roads to capture when trying to climb up. That's, for example, the first person to, we know, who used this ascent, actually descent, to defeat an army was Yehoshua when he came to assist the Gibeonites. He rallied the Kenani by versus Ma'alei Beit Choron. And the second one is Yehuda Maccabee. He takes advantage again of this, of the topography, and routes, ambushes the Greek army as they know about Ma'alei Beit Choron, and Leipzig. I want to mention, I get up here, I explain the things, how these things work naturally. Of course, we thank Hashem, these things are all miracles, and they're not climbing to diminish the miracles in any way. But of course, Yehuda Maccabee, the people went to Mesiras Nefesh, and they went to Mesiras Nefesh for a reason. And they went because they had a reason to fight, because they wanted to keep Mitzvah. Otherwise, they would have never fought in the first place. And even with knowing the topography and everything, they're still at a major disadvantage compared to the Kli Kol. But that doesn't mean that Yehuda Maccabee went, you know, and didn't make any effort. He obviously, he looked around, he knew what's going on around him, and he was obviously, he was a leader, he was a strong guy. Of course, no match to the Seleucid Empire, which in those days is a big empire, but then comes Gorgias. Gorgias realizes, again, he comes along the coast, which again is a non-Jewish population and a friendly population. There's nothing to worry about over there. He gets the support he wants over there. According to the book of the Maccabees, not only that, but a lot of grain came along because they hoped that the Seleucid army will defeat the Jews and then they'll be able to buy slaves for cheap. It mentions that they camped in a place called Ammah, and Ammah today is identified by a place called Emmaus. Anyone going from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim will pass a place called Park Canada. Park Canada is actually sitting on the ancient town of Emmaus, and that is the edge of the hilly region going up to Yerushalayim. But Gorgias already learned the lesson of the two generals before. And he realized that it's too dangerous to start climbing up. So he decided to use another tactic. In the meantime, a very interesting thing. Yehuda Maccabee is up in the hilly region, looking down. He has his spies. He knows what's going on. He takes B'nai Yisrael to a place called Mitzpah. Mitzpah is mentioned in Sefer Shmuel as a place where Shmuel davened before he routed the Philistines. Why did Yehuda Maccabee go to Mitzpah? So the book of the Maccabees explains, because Mitzpah was known to be a place of tefillah for B'nai Yisrael. Take a look at source number 18 on the source page. We have a picture over here of a famous building. For those who have been there to show, you probably have seen this building. This building is called Nebi Samuel, and it's identified by many as the Kever of Shmuel HaNavi. I'm not going to say it's not the Kever of Shmuel HaNavi, but years ago already, the Tzvi Sa'aris and others questioned the possibility of Shmuel HaNavi being buried here geographically does not fit with what it says in Tanakh. An interesting development happened in the last few years. Until 1922, many believed that this hill over here was called Mitzpah. In 1922, excavations were done elsewhere, and most of the people accepted Mitzpah should be identified elsewhere. For the last couple of years, things have changed, and people have been coming back to the conclusion that indeed, this hill over here is Mitzpah. Now, remember, Shmuel is not buried in Mitzpah. Shmuel is buried in Ramah. But Shmuel is always mentioned with Mitzpah, and Shmichos, we have a special tefillah, we mentioned Aneinu, Kishem Shanisa L'Shmuel B'Mitzpah. In other words, Shmuel's name came to this mountain, perhaps not because he's buried there, but because it's a holy mountain, because this is where Shmuel is. So Yehuda Maccabee comes to Mitzpah, and he davens there. Not only he davens there, but at the same time, B'nai Yisrael bring the Bikurim, and they bring the Maisa and all the other crops which are supposed to be brought to Yerushalayim, and they're unable to bring them to Yerushalayim now, because the Beis HaMikdash has not been in service since the beginning of the Hashmoneh Revolt. The Beis HaMikdash is not in service. The people are fasting, that unfortunately they are not able to bring their Korbanos to Yerushalayim. So Yehuda Maccabee camped in Mitzpah, and Gorgias, the Seleucid general, decides to play a little trick on him. Instead of going up with a full army, he takes a few thousand people, and he decides that he's going to sneak up in the dark and in the middle of the night and surprise Yehuda Maccabee. Everyone's going to be asleep in the tents up by the spa, and this is how we'll surprise him, and this is how we'll finish. Yehuda Maccabee evidently got wind of this story, and while Gorgias is climbing up, Yehuda Maccabee leaves torches in his camp near Mitzpah, and he goes down towards Grogan's camp and Malchus. In the camp, the rest of the army is remaining, and Gorgias, the general, is climbing up, while Yehuda Maccabee climbs down. Towards the morning, he arrives at the Greek camp, and he attacks the Greek camp. The Greek camp, of course, is shocked. They're not prepared. They don't have the general, and they all run away. At the same time, Gorgias climbs up, and he reaches Mitzvah, and he sees the camp, and all of a sudden he walks in, and lo and behold, it's empty. And what did you do that trick? And then he turns around and starts going back to his camp, and all of a sudden he sees that his camp is set on fire and everything is burning. And then he realized the trick that Yehuda Maccabee had pulled on him, and he has to run for his life. And Yehuda Maccabee chases his Seleucids all the way to Gezer is a town past Latrun. He prevents them from going farther. Now, as he realizes his disadvantage, he's not going to go into his plain, he's not going to go into a straight area, he'll be at a disadvantage, but in the hilly region, he will rule. Okay, a couple words about, we skipped some things, so let's go back to our Hebrew source page. I mentioned that the Greeks have stopped all the Avodah and the Beis HaMikdash. Take a look at Hebrew source page 2.2. It mentions that with Nimimenu Sarag, the next step on Har HaBayis had a fence, Yud Tzvachim, it was 10 Tzvachim high, which slows its way across the Chayusha. And there were 13 breaches in this fence, Shaparat Shemach HaYavon, that the Greek kings had breached this fence in 13 places. Why did the Greeks breach this fence particularly? So take a look, okay. Take a look at source number 14. And this is a model of the Beis HaMikdash from Zalman Kohen. Take a look on the right side. At the edge of the platform, before the steps, you see a small white little fence with pillars holding up sides. Now, go back to the source page and go to source page number 17. This is very interesting because from all that was in the Beis HaMikdash, the only archaeological evidence that we have that we can directly link to the Beis HaMikdash is this stone over here on the right. Now this is the stone from the Sorek. And the Sorek had a sign on it, some in Greek and some in Latin. This is in Greek. And it warned the foreigner, a non-Jew, that he is punishable by death if he passes this wall. Not only punishable by death, but he's responsible. In other words, you should know that he's going to suffer the consequences. Now, the stone on the right is half of the size of, is half a stone, and the one on the left is a reconstruction of a complete stone. The complete stone is found in Istanbul, can be found in the Museum of Istanbul. The half stone is in the Israel Museum today. So here we have the, as I said, the only direct evidence linking to the Beis HaMikdash is this Sorek. That the Greeks, this is of course much later, these stones are later period, probably from the Herodian period, but similar stones were there in the days of Hanukkah, which warned the Greeks that they're punishable by death if they pass the Sorek. So, okay, now comes battle number four, and this is an interesting thing. We mentioned the topographical situation. And the Hellenists, the Greeks, the Seleucids realized that the only way that they're going to have to find a way to get up to the hilly region and fight on the same level, because if they're going to have to climb up against the Maccabee army, they're not going to make it. And then they decide to come from the south. And in the south, they again have an assistance from a town called Marishah. Now take a look at source number 7. And this is interesting, and this fills in what we said before. Take a look at source number 7. This is a map of what Marishah looked like. Marishah is a town near Lachish, today, the Beit Gubrin area. This is a typical Hellenistic city. Again, streets are crossing each other on a right angle, which was a Greek invention, and a temple, and a couple other public buildings. You'll see nothing in this remaining of this excavation because it's all been covered over. But this is a typical non-Jewish city called Marishah. And using this route coming from the south, the Seleucid army was able to approach and climb into the Judean hills, arriving near Hebron, and then going and pushing north. And pushing north towards Jerusalem. Judah Maccabee, of course, is up in the hills, and he realizes it, and he's going to face them, and the battle will take place again in the year 162 BCE. It'll take place in the town called Beit Tzur, which today is just south of Gush Etzion. There was a victory here. There clearly was a victory. But we cannot say that it was a decisive victory as it was with the first three battles. But it was enough of a victory for Yehuda Maccabee to tell the people, we so far were able to wipe out the Greeks. Now it's time for us to go and restore the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash. And that is when the story of Hanukkah takes place. They go to Yerushalayim, they go to the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash has been out of service for three full years. Plus the Kedaniel points to that. They tear the clothing, the Beis HaMikdash is empty, and they have to do a full restoration, rebuilding the Kelim, and one of those Kelim is the menorah. The menorah at the time, we have our Hebrew source page over here, that's the Gemara Menorah, part of the Daf Yomi, source 6.2, it mentions that a person today is not allowed to make a menorah similar to one that was in Beis HaMikdash. So the Gemara says, you're not allowed to make a menorah with seven branches, you can make one with eight, you can make one with six, but not seven branches, even not only from gold. The Torah says to make it from gold, but if you make it from any other metal, it's also kosher. Rabbi Yosef Avinu says you can't make it from wood either, because the Chashmonaim, when they made the menorah, they made it from wood, meaning they were so poor at the time, they couldn't afford anything else. So he told them, no, it wasn't a wooden menorah, it was a metal menorah that was covered with lead, and eventually they can afford to fix it. If you know, later on they had to buy something more expensive, they made one from silver, eventually they made one from gold. If you look at the source page, source number 15, you see a model of a menorah. You see a model of a menorah. This is a modern day menorah made of gold, to size of what the menorah in the second Beis HaMikdash, the rich menorah at the end, is assumed to look like. This is based on what we know from, if you take a look at number 16, there is a picture of the Arch of Titus. And Titus, when he defeated the Jews and destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, he took the spoil from the Beis HaMikdash. And one of the things, of course, he showed on this archway is the menorah. Why the menorah? Because the Jews, again, in Hanukkah, were victorious with the menorah. And the other thing he shows on the trumpets. Because when the Jews went to war, they carried the trumpets. So based on this menorah, the menorah has been reconstructed in gold. It can be seen today in the Cairo and the Old City. So the miracle happens, and there comes the Gemara Shabbos, source number 6.1, when Kislev, the Gemara says, 8 days of Hanukkah, not to fast. When they came into the Heichal, the Yevanim had defiled all the oil, and when the Chashmonaim were victorious, they found a small jug of oil that had the seal of a Kohen Gadol, and it was enough to light for one day, and the people were telling me the only way that they can have star oil is 7 days. Another reason is that the Greeks had destroyed all the olive groves around, and the closest place was a 4 day distance, believed to be a place called Tekoa up north, modern day Tekin, 4 days travel each way, and the oil was enough to last for one day, and it lasted for 8 days. I mentioned to you, if you go to the source page, this number 10, a very interesting thing. This, I'm sorry, came out a little too large, but it was too late for me to fix it. This is a seal of Yonatan Kohen Gadol. It says on it, Yerushalayim. So this is the only seal that we actually have that carries the name of the Kohen Gadol. It's believed to be none other than Yonah, King Yonah. So here we have a Chashmonai Kohen Gadol. This seal is written in the ancient Hebrew script. This seal can be seen today in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. So this is one seal. Again, this is enlarged, greatly enlarged, a seal of a Kohen Gadol. So the next of Hanukkah happens, and that's what Hanukkah is established. I want to finish off, and the story didn't end over here. This was the end of the decrees against the Jews. But a year later, the Seleucids came back. And they came from the same place, as I told you, the victory in Beit Tzur was not such a decisive victory, and the Seleucids tried their luck again from the south, and this time they came with the heavy weapons, which were the elephants, and this time they were victorious, and the Jews were defeated, and eventually the Beit HaMikdash was captured again by the Seleucids. And if it was captured again, you may ask, so why the purpose of celebrating Hanukkah if it all went down the drain a year later? And the answer is, it's true that the Beit HaMikdash was captured again by the Greeks, but the Greeks realized that the Jews are stubborn people. Don't mess with them. Let them keep their religion. In other words, what happened, the advantage was that now the Jews are free to keep their religion. Now, time is short, briefly, so in modern history, the story of Hanukkah has taken a little change. Until 100 years ago, the story of Hanukkah meant Mesiras Nefesh. It meant sacrifice. People were persecuted by the Christians in Europe, by the Muslims, and took inspiration from Mesiras Nefesh from the story of Hanukkah. But over the last 100 years, in modern-day Zionism, people took the story of Hanukkah and distorted it. And they took it, we know, and the Rambam quotes, I'm not going to read it because time is short, but the Rambam appears over here on the Hebrew source, page 341. The Rambam says that after the victory of Hanukkah, the Jewish Melucha, the Jewish kingdom, remained another 200 years. The 103 years of the Hashemite dynasty and the 103 years of Hezekiah. So the definition of and took a meaning of independence. Meaning the people who came there as Israel to fight for independence got inspiration from the story of Hanukkah and distorted the whole meaning of Hanukkah to commemorate the independence, that the Hashmonaim actually were able to acquire independence. Now, it's true that the Rambam mentions it. It's true that it's a great thing that the Jews were able to acquire independence, but that is not the story of Hanukkah. The Jews who went to the Mesiras Nefesh to fight didn't go to fight for independence. They went to fight for the right to keep the Torah. Now, interestingly, is that in battle number 8, Yehuda Maccabee is faced by a mass Greek army, and he is outnumbered, and everyone's telling him, let's run away, because we don't stand a chance. And Yehuda Maccabee insists, we don't run away, we'll fight. And he fought, and he was killed. Now, the reason why he had such a small army was because after the Seleucids, by then, Antiochus had already died, but after the Seleucids had already annulled the decrees against the Jews, a lot of his army deserted him because they said, why are we fighting for? There's no purpose in fighting if there's no purpose in fighting if we're ready to keep Mitzvah. Fighting for independence, that's not what we're interested in. That wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to fight in order to keep Torah. The last source I have over here, 7.1, is a quote from the Rambam. And it's a very interesting quote from the Rambam. The Gemara tells us that if anyone came along and said that he has good lineage, he comes from the Hashmonai family, then you know that he is actually a slave, halachically, because no one was left from the Hashmonai family. In other words, they were all wiped out. Now, of the five brothers, no one died a natural death. They were all killed in battle. And the Rambam says, why was it that these people who are so holy, why was it that they suffered such a tragedy and nothing remained? And the Rambam says an interesting thing. He says, because on Pei Halacha, king only is supposed to come from Shevet Yehuda, from Malchus Yisrael. So when they won the war, they should have restored the kingship to Malchus Yisrael. And they didn't. So therefore they were punished. But at the same time the Rambam says, if not for the Hashmonaim, there would be no Jewish people today. None will be left. A few stubborn people who had this inspiration to fight were able to overpower the massive army. But again, the inspiration was one thing. It's Mesiras Nefesh to keep Torah and Mitzvah. So that's the lesson that we are supposed to keep
The Gemara says that all the holidays that happened in the second Beis HaMikdash, and all the great days, the only two that remain today after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, are Chanukah and Purim. And that would be the things that even though there's no Beis HaMikdash, but there's still a reason to celebrate. Because it's not an issue. Had it been independent, there's no reason for me today to celebrate that the Jews acquired independence then, especially since it didn't last for too long. The one thing that they acquired and remained is the ability to keep Torah and Mitzvot without the government interfering. So that's the message that we're supposed to take for this Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah to everyone. Thank you.